Hello again, and welcome to The Global Exchange, part of the CJAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we are rebroadcasting a segment from our third annual Canada State of Trade Conference, which took place on March 10, 2020 at the Rideau Club in Ottawa. This is the EDC overview of facts and figures presentation by Stephen Tapp, the Deputy Chief Economist from Export Development Canada. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker back for the second year in a row because he did such a terrific job last year. That is Stephen Tapp, Deputy Chief Economist at Export Development Canada. And unlike last year, which I just introduced him as that, I've been given a biography.
There's more, yes.
As the Deputy Chief Economist and Director of the Economic Research and Analysis Department at Export Development Canada, Stephen helps oversee EDC's forecasts and survey of Canadian exporters. And believe me, he is busy these days. Brief senior management and global trade developments. And it goes on to say, yes, you were. Well, this is where actually we first ran across each other. And actually, I think it was may have been Ailish introduced us. Stephen was Research Director at the Institute for Research on Public Policy. His research was awarded, and congratulations on this, the Doug Purvis Prize for Canadian Economic Policy, and you're published in many journals, and you're kind of the prelude to a panel we're going to have this afternoon with economists, but because you do such a good job, you get the first half hour to yourself. Stephen, take it away.
Thank you very much, Colin. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. So we don't do slides for the rest of the day, so what my charge has been from Colin is to pack as many slides as I can pack in the next 30 minutes so that you get your full money's worth here. So, yeah, I'll post the slides so you can get every number and every detail you want later on. Last year, Colin's right, we opened the presentation discussing the Chinese proverb or the Chinese curse that we are living in interesting times, and I didn't think it was possible, but as of moving from last year and thinking back, I think we're in even more interesting times now in terms of where we're at for global trade, the global economy, the series of shocks that has hit the economy, most recently the U.S.-China trade shock, what's happened with the coronavirus, and then the price of oil just falling, the barrel falling out of that yesterday. So I'm going to call this a series of shocking events, and I'm going to give you a bunch of slides to back up what I have to say on the trade wars. So the first point, which I think is abundantly clear now, is that Donald Trump's assault on the global trading system has wide-ranging impacts, and these impacts have been adding up. Let's go through some of those. So this is the man of steel right here, the tariff man. And financial markets have really been kind of on edge, one tweet away from really moving down considerably or looking at some good news, and the tariff threat has come off and then reviving. I think we've learned a couple things. First, we know that the trade wars are not good. I think that we knew that before Trump tweeted. We know that they're not easy to win. We have seen the losers outnumbering the winners pretty considerably in terms of our survey, in terms of the impacts on the data. And finally, trade wars are not easy to end either. As the U.S. And China phase one trade truce continues the trade war to some extent. So let's go through some charts on this. Trump's trade tariffs on China put in perspective over longer term. I'm going to look at the share of U.S. goods imports from China to the U.S. that are subject to some type of special duty. This could be anti-dumping, countervailing duty, this type of thing. We see back in 1980, about maybe a third or so of the value of U.S. goods coming in from China had some type of additional duty beyond the MFN. That over the decades fell and fell. Before Trump came in office, about 8% of Chinese goods had some type of additional tariff on them. And through successive rounds, starting back in 2017 through to 2018, we've seen that ramp up. And now, by our count, about $360 billion worth of U.S. Imports, which is about over two-thirds or 70% of U.S. imports are covered by these additional tariffs. So a lot, this is sort of saying that in terms of the basket of U.S. imports from China, a lot of this is covered. And we've more or less locked these rates in going forward in the phase one deal. And the rates are pretty high. So the average tariff rate when Trump came into office was 3%. That's the MFN rate. It has increased now on an average basis. A few tariffs were rolled back marginally in one of the last rounds, but by our add up, it's about 19%, the average tariff rate. So not only are over two-thirds of goods coming in, the tariff rate is pretty high. On the other side, China has responded more or less in lockstep, meeting in retaliation tit for tat. So the rate from China on U.S. imports at the MFN rate before was 8%. It has risen to over 25%. And at the same time, one of the untold stories is China has actually reduced its MFN rate on other economies. So while China has responded in kind, increasing trade barriers against the U.S., they've reduced them elsewhere. And so these are pretty significant. When you look at what's happening in terms of bilateral trade, so U.S. and China trade is only 5% of global trade, but we've seen the equivalent of a recession happening in terms of the bilateral trade. So when you look back at what happened in the global recession, when you look back to the progressive tariff rates that have come in, you essentially see the same types of magnitude. So big reductions in terms of the goods that are being hit by that. And so I want to go a couple kind of test cases here of where can we be very concrete and start adding up what the impacts are of the trade war. So one is the steel aluminum tariffs. So when Trump initially had announcements right here, this is the pre-tariff average. I'm going to look at Canadian exports of tariffed steel aluminum products. So in early 2017, there were some Department of Commerce reports. Initially, Mexico and Canada and the European Union were not impacted by the tariffs. So there was a point in time where there was speculation where we would or would not be covered. Trump brought this in to kind of negotiate leverage in terms of NAFTA renegotiations. And what you see before the tariffs came in place is some preemptive stockpiling. So businesses looked forward and thought, we're going to be hit with a rate of 10% or 25%. We're going to move some stuff across the border as quickly as we can. And they did that. So you see the stockpiling phase. But then you see for the year in which the tariffs were in place, a significant reduction as inventories were drawn down, and our trade plummets by about 16% in terms of the impacts. By our estimate here, this is worth about $2.4 billion of lost Canadian exports of steel and aluminum, which are not coming back, which were hit during this tariff war. And the big thing about this is we didn't get a big reduction in terms of production in the U.S. economy. The sort of capacity utilization rates in steel and aluminum did not really come back in any significant manner. So this was more or less negotiating leverage, which was used to not very effect, but it hurt Canada. Let's think of a second example of where Canada has been hit. This is more of the collateral damage. Canada arresting the CFO of Huawei in Vancouver, that leading to detention of two Michaels and some other bans on imports of initially canola, and then we moved it to beef and pork. So what happened to Canada's exports to China? Well, Canada's exports to China had been growing by about 10% a year over the last few decades, which was pretty impressive, very strong growth. And they fell in this episode, just in terms of level terms, they're $4.6 billion lower in 2019 than they were in 2018. If you factor in the fact that growth was about 10% overall there, the impact is really closer to $7.8 billion. So we have this initial sector-specific hit on steel aluminum, and then we look at kind of bilateral Canada stuck in the middle, and the numbers are starting to add up there. Let's think about what are the aggregate of the macro costs of this, not just bilaterally and not just sort of sector-specific. Well, the Bank of Canada has done some work on that in their monetary policy report, and they estimate the impact of trade tensions on both the level of Canadian GDP and the level of global GDP, if this were to continue, relative to a baseline where there is no trade tensions, what would be the impact on the level of GDP by the end of next year? They think we're about halfway through this, but in terms of locking in the tariffs, if this continues, Canada will be hit harder than the world because we are more exposed to trade to the U.S. And because we're more trade intensive in general. And so the impact would be about 1.8% on Canadian GDP and about 1.2% on global GDP by the math that we do in our forecast. That would be about $44 billion less of economic activity in Canada and over $1 trillion in economic activity being caught up in these trade wars globally. So I would say I think I submit to you in terms of the economic impacts, they're very real and they're accumulating as we go by the day. There has been some partial reprieve, though. So we've learned, as I say, bilateral trade between the U.S. and China is only, if I can say only, 5% of global trade. So 95% of other trade was not hit directly by these tariffs. We've seen some offsets in terms of exchange rate adjustments. So the U.S. dollar has appreciated. The renminbi in successive rounds, the renminbi was coming down, depreciating a little bit as well. And so we've seen some measures with firms kind of moving goods and shipments around to avoid these tariffs. And now we have CUSMA, USMCA, the USMCA deal. And this is a good thing. What that will do is essentially take one of the big irritants and one of the big concerns that Canadian exporters have in terms of North American trade rules. Hopefully that will lessen the uncertainty we have of that. This will keep duty-free trade going for most goods sectors. This will increase rules of origin requirements for auto. This will improve labor and environment standards. As we got closer to Congress approval in the U.S., they've added some enforcements on the labor side. And they've removed some of the intellectual property provisions that were added on before. So I think Global Affairs Monitoring, Aaron is here as well. I think the Global Affairs work that's been done looks at a case of having a NAFTA versus a no-new NAFTA, and it certainly is better for Canada to be in the NAFTA than not be in the NAFTA. I think that's true. So that's good. And this bill, C-100, is sitting now in Parliament. We expect that to be passed at some point in time, as Canada's the last person across the finish line. And that will provide some help to Canadian exporters in this troubled times. And then you can see from this very awkward handshake depicted here by the phase one trade deal. This was at the point in time where actually we knew that coronavirus existed in China, by the way. So that maybe that would explain why the handshake is kind of backwards into the sign. So we have a phase one trade deal, and that's good, I guess. Markets initially reacted quite positively to that. Then we started to look through the details of this 86-page agreement and thought, well, is this really all it's cracked up to be? This is a trade truce. It's not a trade deal. This is keeping in place a high level of tariffs, which I showed you before. There is no real enforcement mechanism. If one side thinks that the other side is not upholding commitments, they can increase tariffs, they can withdraw from the deal. So it's a pretty shaky foundation, I think, for a trade deal. It doesn't really address some of the fundamental irritants. And if anything, this is increasing Chinese intervention in terms of the trade markets, given what we have here. One of the key markers of this was a $200 billion commitment over this year and next year for China to increase purchases of a bunch of different products. So as I say, this is really locking in Chinese intervention in the economy, which was the opposite of what Trump said he wanted to do. And what this does is put some Canadian exports at risk because we are selling to China some of these very same products. The analysis that we've done looking at energy, manufactured good, and agriculture, which are the ones that are covered by the Phase 1 deal, and then those that are not affected, so looking at Canadian trade there, $12 billion in U.S. terms of Canadian exports to China are covered by products that are in this Phase 1 deal. So that's about 56% of our exports to China, and this is not a huge and sort of existential threat, but this is a very clear and very real threat. We went through the math in terms of what is the U.S. capacity to produce these, what are the other producers in terms of Argentina, whether they can fill slots and these types of things. There will be some clear trade diversion. So China will be looking more to buy from the U.S. on the margin than from other producers. So that's against WTO rules at the end of the day and is going to be problematic. But if we had a WTO appellate body to appeal to, that would be a little bit easier fight. But we are particularly worried about things like soybeans, like lobster. So seafood was the thing where we had a big win. When tariffs came on, let's say, lobster from Maine, Canada rushed in, Atlantic Canada picked up some of that market share. On the opposite side now, now it looks like there's going to be more preference given to purchases of U.S. So lobster, things like wood, meat. In addition to meat on the CPTPP, we had seen some big gains for Canadian exports to Japan. And now what happens is there's a very narrow U.S.-Japan trade deal, and so some of those gains are going to be at risk. So Canadian exports are at risk from some of the U.S. trade actions. I think that's clear as well. How are Canadian exporters feeling? So I said we talk to our Canadian exporters twice a year, 1,000 of them in a lot of detail, add up the impacts on that. Well, what's happening with exports right now? They're pretty weak. I think that's not surprising. Canadian export confidence is relatively low. So here's the export slump, as I'm calling it. This is looking just at merchandise exports here. So you can see through 2016, 2017, and 2018, we had some pretty decent growth. Global economy was picking up. Canadian exports were benefiting in that. And the 12-month trend here, you've seen really a big reduction through the second half of the year as we've had a slowing in global growth, the tariffs in the sort of general trade uncertainty weighing on things. We've had some domestic rail blockades. We've had transportation bottlenecks. We've had the price of oil towards the end of last year really being a problem at WCS. So there's a lot of things that have been going on kind of holding back trade. So we see this as a relatively kind of middling or sidelining, pretty subdued Canadian export performance. In terms of the survey that we do, we asked exporters, what do they think about the level of protections that they're seeing? Do they expect this to go down anytime soon? So in the next year, this survey was done at the end of last year, 90% of respondents say that they think the level of protections will either increase in the year ahead or will stay the same. So I think that's obviously concerning as well. We only have about 10% of Canadian exporters thinking things will get better. This was, by the way, the survey was done before the formal announcement of the China-U.S., so things may have been a bit better. But looking at that survey question a few times, we've still seen a very high level Canadian exporters thinking that protectionism is in basically a new normal stage as of Trump being in office in the U.S. And when we ask particular questions about what concerns or what obstacles exporters are facing in foreign markets, typically, top answers include things like financing, which EDC is happy to be able to help, information problems, logistics, hiring skilled talent. These are all kind of perennial problems. Over in the most recent surveys, trade barriers have shot up from being very low on the list to being very high on the list, and the most important thing right now. So Canadian exporters are telling us trade barriers are a problem for their trade. And the Trade Confidence Index, which EDC produces, is now down in the most recent survey. The last three have gone down. And we are looking at a level now which is tracking more or less where we were at in the European sort of sovereign debt crisis in 2012. This is the lowest level it's been in 8 years. And we've done some work to overlay the forward-looking questions. So saying, will your export sales increase? Do you see better opportunities in international markets? Moving that ahead 6 months in the future and looking at where we see actual non-energy export growth, our expectation, given what happened at the end of last year, is that we'll have very weak growth in real energy, non-energy exports in Canada in the first half of the year. This was, again, all happening before COVID-19. And so this was the economy in a weak position before, and now you're hit with a viral shock, pandemic, which is not very good. So let's try to diagnose. This is not, I think, as we've been learning through this on the forecasting side and thinking through the impacts of this in real time, it's not one shock. Initially, people said this is a supply shock. Well, it's not just a supply shock. It's multiple shocks happening on both the supply side and demand side. It's useful to think through what we're seeing and what the potential impacts could be. So on the supply side, yes, it's a health shock. Yes, social distancing and containment measures will reduce labor supply temporarily in the most impacted sectors. Of course, there will be supply chain disruptions. So I'm going to show you a chart in a second after this, looking at things like smartphones, pharma products, auto exports in Southeast Asia will be hit particularly hard, whereas Wuhan was a hub for some of these production supply chains. This will be a liquidity crunch for Tier 2 suppliers and SMEs in particular. That will be problematic as credit spreads have increased. And on the demand side, I think the biggest impact is more psychological in terms of the confidence hits that we're seeing to business confidence, to consumer confidence. We are seeing financial market wealth shocks. So we've had correction over the last few months in financial markets. Yesterday, as I'm updating my slides this morning at 6 a.m., we had to add another 7.5% reduction in the S&P yesterday. So this is, even for people that own stocks, this is a shock as they're seeing the headlines of global wealth is disintegrating here. It's a temporary income shock for people who do services or people who are in precarious situations who may not be able to supply as much labor as they want. They could have liquidity issues. Now, the consumption side, I think services, you don't store services. Services need to be done kind of person to person. So we should see a very dramatic reduction in services, and people eventually will not be making up for getting four haircuts next month, but there should be a big rebound eventually in the second half of the year if this is contained. But on services side, auto sales, durables are not doing very well. New home sales, where people have to go through and look at people's homes. These things have been hit. On the upside, though, as I mentioned, my wife sent me to Superstore, and the toilet paper sales and the fights that were going on in the aisles, people were stocking up like it was going to be Armageddon on Saturday. So I can say, at least in Westboro, Superstore sales have probably increased, and people are kind of in preventative measure. Precautionary savings have increased, and there should probably be less discretionary spending. And so the big thing is, what's the policy response going to be? We've seen from the G7, G20 issue, there's going to be a coordinated stimulus response to some extent. First movers out of there were the Federal Reserve last Wednesday, coming out of cycle with an emergency 50 basis point cut, which was not well received by markets, expecting more to come. So people thought, okay, we're sort of stemming some of the tide, but there's got to be more cuts. Bank Canada followed the next day with a 50 basis point cut as well, which had not been priced in at all even a week before. On the fiscal side, we're likely to see some more targeted transfers to households, individuals, businesses that could be under pressure. There is pressure on Morneau government and the budget to move things forward and to have something steady to say about this. Now, on the trade side, I started thinking, well, what could trade policy do? Well, trade policy could undo what trade policy has already done. So if you wanted to reduce tariffs that have been put in place that were 25% and slash them down to effectively zero with the sign of a pen, Trump and Xi could do that. That would be a jolt of confidence to markets, and that would help. Some of the supply chains are stuck right now, but that would be something which trade policy could actually, in terms of we were not liberalizing, we could liberalize very quickly and provide some confidence to support markets there. And so let me show you just a picture of the ICT or smartphone market. We've got China in terms of an assembler central hub. China had been kind of locked down there for a while in Wuhan. We've then had hits in Japan and in Korea. So Apple is delaying some production of their smartphones. The impact will be on U.S. consumers, also feeding through to Europe. So the idea just is when we have a supply chain, we have a breakage or a weak link somewhere, there's going to be impacts felt throughout the supply chains. The OECD was quick in their interim forecast to be, I wouldn't say overly alarmist, but very clear in terms of the present dangers that are in the economic outlook right now. They said the world economy is at its most precarious position since the global financial crisis. I think that that's true. Global trade was already contracting in 2019, had a very bad year, all things considered, before. So this is global merchandise trade volumes, and you can see we had decent growth of around, let's say, 2 to 4% happening as things were picking up in 2017 and 18. Things have slowed down. Global trade and global growth in 2019 registered its worst performance in this part of the business cycle, the last decade or so. So trade was already hit. Here's Chinese production. I'm going to show you first. U.S. from purchasing managers indices, anything above 50 is in expansion mode. So U.S. was kind of doing okay in terms of its manufacturing production. Manufacturing wasn't doing well. In Europe, we had adjustments to emission standards in Germany, which kind of preloaded some spending and then put them in more or less into recession territory for most of 2019. But the chart that you really need to see here is the one where we had to update the y-axis when we got the PMIs from China last Saturday. Oh, that just kind of fell off a cliff there. So we have this going from February's data of 35.7 reading in China. So what they had to do for the most recent trade data for January and February was lumped together the 2 months so that we wouldn't see how bad February was. And the show there was minus 17.4% for Chinese trade. I think numbers could be even worse as they're revised in the future. Financial markets are panicking. So I had, again, updated this chart this morning, looking back to what we've had from the start of the year. Now, it should be kept in mind that financial markets were doing really, really, really well, irrationally well before this. So we're coming off of very, very high levels. But we had that big bounce when I was down in Mexico for the week. And every time I looked at my portfolio, things had gotten worse and worse. And then things kind of stabilized, but were very choppy. And then yesterday, as the price of oil fell, we saw the biggest decline in the S&P since the great financial crisis. We have seen bond spreads, so investors discriminating, moving into investment grade and moving away from things like shale oil producers who are going to be under pressure. So credit spreads for sub-investment grades are increasing dramatically. And the rate cuts. So we had a series of rate cuts, 25 basis points at a time, three times for the trade war, which was insurance from Jerome Powell. And then we had the out-of-cycle COVID-19 cut. Markets are expecting on March 19th another 50 basis points. And they price in even more, kind of looking forward to essentially getting back to zero lower bound territory coming forward. Then, as we were looking at data on Sunday night, we saw the price of oil in terms of the movements as Saudis turned the tap on and are threatening a global price war. In Europe, we saw the biggest reduction in oil prices since the Operation Desert Storm. Now, I don't know which, some of you guys were actually working back in Desert Storm. I don't know what I was doing back in Desert Storm. That's a long time ago, and that's a pretty big oil price drop that we're seeing right now. And there's going to be some big impacts on Canadian producers for sure. At this point, I'm kind of feeling like this is how we feel. This is all very fine. So Colin probably didn't want me to start with the whole rambling of how much series of shocks we've had and how bad it's been. But it's been pretty bad, let's be honest. Now, looking on the other side, there are some opportunities here for Canada to do some things. There'll be some discussions throughout other sessions today. One, we had a big panel yesterday. I think Mark was there. Discussions between Canada and the European Union. CETA is, I think, something that's coming along at the right time. So at a point in time where Canadians are looking to diversify, CETA has come along. We have seen exports to the European Union increase faster than in the rest of the economy. We've seen tariff preference rate uses increasing on both sides of the border, and people had kind of looked initially in the first few months of data and said, well, there's nothing happening. The Europeans are picking up trade. We're not. We're very slow off the mark. I'm not sure that's entirely true, and I think it depends on what you mean. So this is work done by Global Affairs in their State of Trade publication. And if you think about things that had no, or let's say a very low MFN tariff before, they're not going to be impacted by the tariff cuts. And so you wouldn't expect there to be a big response of exports. And for those goods, we didn't see any movement in prices, and we didn't see any movement in quantities. However, for the prices where there was a 5 percentage point reduction in tariffs or more, In the first year, the deal, Canadian exports to the European Union increased by 25%. So the general narrative, I think, is incorrect to say that Canadian exporters have not taken advantage of some of this deal. We've seen the types of things where CGE modeling suggested on autos, industrial M&E, chemicals, plastics, manufacturing parts. These are the areas where tariff cuts have come down the most, and these are areas where we've seen trade pick up the most. And when we look geographically as well, we've seen Atlantic Canada benefiting more than the rest of Canada, which gravity models would suggest. So I think at the end of the day, what we're seeing, it's pretty preliminary. It's only been 2 years or so now in the deal, but CETA's looking so far so good. Services, there'll be a services panel. And so I've done some work with Beiling Yan, who's at StatsCan now and working on administrative data sets. The work that we did was trying to use data for all the firms in Canada that paid corporate income taxes from 2000 to 2015 and look not just at the current exporters, but try to figure out who are the potential exporters of the future. So looking in the same industries with same levels of employment and same observable characteristics, how can we figure out who these kind of next exporters are in the margins? Our best guess is that in terms of commercial services alone, Canadian commercial services, there are 3,000 companies in Canada who look similar to companies that are exporting but are not exporting. So the math that we do is if all of these companies were to become exporters and were exporting at the same percentage as existing exporters, that would be worth $28 billion in terms of potential exports to be realized. So we're pretty bullish in terms of the outlook for the services sector. This note, I think, should be published this week, so you can look at the details or I'll send it to you if you like. Another thing that we're seeing is how are Canadian exporters responding? So if we only look at exports and we look at merchandise exports, we're seeing the things that are being hit hardest. But in fact, what's happening is Canadian exporters are shifting the way that they're serving foreign consumers. And one of the ways they're doing that is with CDIA, so outward foreign direct investment into end markets in the U.S. If the tariff barriers are going to be high, they'll invest directly in the U.S. market or they'll invest directly in the Chinese market or the German market. And in our survey, we have seen of the percentage of exporters who have investments abroad, that had been around 14%, it actually fell off before 2016, but we've seen a pretty sustained increase here from the low of 10% of exporters having investments abroad to now 17%, which in our survey is the highest level. So in terms of activities of exporters, a lot of this is less focused on domestic production and more focused on how do we get to end consumers, how do we get to them where they're at. And so we're seeing kind of a different way that we're serving foreign consumers. Okay, so I opened last time with this chart from The Economist, which was the Nervous Beaver, which I thought at that point in time had kind of nicely captured the Canadian heroic, multilateral, orderly, institutionalist view of the world. And we had this encroaching jungle, which you have seen from various, we have various different things pictured there. But the idea that the beaver was nervous. And I think if the beaver was nervous last year, the beaver is still nervous this year. But Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland has some advice for us, and that is you have to keep watering the garden. See the garden every spring and harvest every fall, and notice that the jungle is encroaching. So the jungle is encroaching. At the end of the day, gardens are a lot better than jungles. I think there's a lot of truth to that. And when we look at the appellate body back in its heyday as it was operating in 2012, we see lots of people. As we met last year in February, it was down to 4 people. And then the U.S. was blocking additional appointments. And then at this point today, we have WCO appellate body gone, but not forgotten. But I think the key point here to make is that into the void, the Canadian beaver stepped in. Canada, the European Union, and 50 other countries, including China, but not the U.S., have created a makeshift kind of process to keep things going in the absence of multilateral system. And that's kind of the best work that we can do. That's what we need to do to kind of keep Canadian trade moving and the multilateral system from collapsing. So let me conclude now. Oh, I still have 4 minutes, Colin, to tell you about my favorite books. Good. There's been a series of shocks. I think you're probably aware of these shocks. The costs of the trade war are pretty high. COVID-19 is a very serious, very real risk. Oil price shocks on top of these shocks, markets are pretty nervous. And we see recession is very real in a variety of economies, including Japan, including Italy, so G7 economies being hit, and some other sector-specific shocks as well. The global risks are very high right now. In the short term, I think that we'll see a lot more market volatility and continued weakness of global trade and Canadian trade. There should be, if COVID-19 and policy steps in and kind of stabilizes confidence, production that didn't take place at the first half of the year, we should see some bounce back in activity, some pretty vigorous pickup in the second half of the year, hopefully, fingers crossed. And then I got to thinking, well, can this health crisis really be the one thing where we haven't had a lot of global cooperation over the last decade? Maybe this is the one thing that can get people serious to sit together in a room and say, let's kind of get rid of this trade war. This is in everybody's interest, as one example, among other things that we can do. And for Canadian Opportunities, I think, longer term, it's not all down, it's not all dire. There'll be much more discussions and many more panels today to talk about some of the upsides, things we can do. CETA, I think, is going well, and I think is doing better than some of the credit it gets in the media. The services side, we see some pretty significant impacts and pretty significant potential to grow Canadian commercial services exports in the future. We're seeing a lot more activity through outward foreign direct investment, so that's just to keep in mind. If we're only looking at merchandise trade data, we're missing a lot of the activity. And for the Canadian beaver, we just need to kind of keep gardening. So you can read lots more details here on the edc.ca website, as I'm paid to say. And then you can get a hold of me on Twitter, as I follow Trump on Twitter and comment on everything that's happening. And Colin's going to ask me this anyway, so now with my remaining 3 seconds, I always read multiple books at the same time, but I read The Four last week when I was on that vacation. It's pretty incredible read when you think about what's happening at Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. These are the companies that have global domination of data and analytics, and it's pretty scary. I think everybody should read this to better understand the way the global economy is shaping up. Not as much of a page-turner. From Mr. Applebaum of the New York Times, goes through a historical take on, from Martin Feldstein up through the global financial crisis, what is the impact that economists have had on public policy? And it's a pretty interesting read, very detailed, historical. Now go take on the world. Excellent. We have 1 minute left. Should I just get off stage?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Stephen, thank you very much. There's a reason why we ask you to do the Tour d'Horizon, because you do it so well and you make the dismal science, you know, almost fun. And I think as we move into a prepper economy, it is good to know all the dimensions. And I'm glad you ended on at least some notes of optimism. You know, 2 cheers or maybe 3 cheers for the CETA.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. Today, we listened to a panel from our third annual Canada State of Trade Conference. If you like the show, remember to give us a rating on your podcast app. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to producer Jay Rankin and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on The Global Exchange.